You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 10th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. As a French magazine experiences ruthless aggression at the hands of terrorists, satire and the people that produce it take centre stage. Cartoonists, journalists and editors take stock of tragic events in Paris this week on The Stack. The world watched in horror as armed extremists raided the offices of controversial satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in the heart of Paris this week. The magazine's cartoons had shocked and angered many Muslims for their unfettered and mocking depiction of the Prophet. Charlie Hebdo refused to tone down and continued to print its covers with their often arresting imagery. On the 7th of January, 10 of Charlie Hebdo's staff were murdered, and the very notions of freedom of speech and freedom of religious expression have subsequently been called into question. A humble printed magazine with courageous and intellectual intentions, provocations with tragic consequences. Like never before, a magazine and the pages it produces have gripped global attention. On The Stack, we'll be discussing the limits of satire with the editor of France's most iconic weekly magazine, Paris Match, and Private Eye's head cartoonist, as well as The Telegraph's political sketch writer. We'll also be hearing from a senior journalist who visited Charlie Hebdo's offices back in 2012.
Much of what Charlie Hebdo is about is exposing hypocrisy and hatred. And as they saw it, and as the survivors presumably still see it, it is about exposing religion.
That's all coming up on this special edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review programme. Now, before we kick off the discussion here in the studio, let's hear from Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who's in Switzerland at the moment and joins me now to look at what's been an extraordinary last few days in a bit more detail. Tyler, thanks for being on The Stack as ever, of course. Let's talk about what this means, I guess, for print, the really big picture. What's your sort of immediate reactions as the dust, of course, is still settling?
I guess there are two strands to this, because here we are in the weekend. This is a story which, of course, broke in Europe on Wednesday morning. And I think so many people, whether you're in news organizations or you're just, of course, the lay viewer, listener, reader, whatever it is, this has really been driven over the last few days by television, certainly by radio, by the web. And it'll be interesting to see the role that analysis plays this weekend. And I know that I'm, you know, very much looking forward to settling down with my favorite newspapers today and on Sunday just to get a more considered view, because I think one of the things, and I think it's been one of the most significant shifts, Tom, that we've seen, not just with the Charlie Hebdo case, but I think with big breaking news stories probably over the last 2 or 3 years, the speed at which social media moves, we really moved into an era where so often we're just hearing unconfirmed reports, you know, we can't confirm this. And I think there was a time, you know, even rewind 5 or 6 years ago, where you didn't have this type of speculative presentation. You know, many news organizations, they just wouldn't go with it unless it could be corroborated by 2 or 3 sources. So I think the role of print, where you're able to, of course, have the luxury of analysis, I think that's one big component. And I think the second area, you know, area as well, it will be amazing what happens next week when Charlie Hebdo, you know, if we're to believe certainly the initial print runs, that they're talking that it'll be upwards of 1 million copies that are going to be hitting the streets around France, you know, indeed all over Europe, I would imagine, come next week, when this was a magazine which was actually printing thousands of copies or your tens of thousands at the top end.
Let me bring you back to that point you're making, though, about the sort of changes we might see then in the sort of broad editorial environment, because do you think this will prompt a bit of a re-evaluation? It'll certainly prompt reflection in terms of what the news gathering operation looks like, maybe even how opinion is written and presented. Do you think we're going to see something, if not of a watershed, at least of a reappraisal?
I think that this is already happening. It already has been happening. I think we've seen, we could call it a creeping political correctness, which has entered, you know, many newsrooms, and of course part of this is just, you know, self-censorship on the side of journalists or people who are running the opinion pages. Where is that line? That's one component of it. I think you also see it amongst young journalists, you know, even within our own organization. You bring in a new generation of journalists who maybe just wouldn't want to push it as far because they don't want to offend anybody, or they don't want to ruffle any feathers. And that's just, it's a very, very different type of way of thinking, maybe compared to when I, or I think many of our colleagues in our own organization, or certainly many others, when we entered this business. And I think that'll be, it's a huge danger. I think it's one that we try to correct within Monocle, and I think that it's certainly going to be a big fight, which is going to exist in newsrooms and in editorial floors elsewhere.
Tyler, let me just sort of close by asking you, I guess, for a bit more of a personal reflection. We've talked often about protecting journalists, and often the frame of reference for that is in, you know, war zones, in territories where people are aware of the very immediate dangers they face. What have been your reflections over the past few days, given that the very direct nature of this, the fact that it was in, you know, Paris, one of our, you know, great sort of metropolises? Do you think that that also prompts a further reconsideration about the practice of journalism, the safety of that occupation?
I think what it does prove is that no matter what happens, and of course, you know, everyone who's been close enough to the story will know that this was a media institution which was under police protection. It had been under police protection for a long time. Of course, it had been firebombed before. We have to remember that, you know, even within the reception of Libération last year, a gunman came in, shot someone from the photo team of that paper. So, you know, there are only, you know, so many I guess, barriers. There are only so many security guards. There's only so much police protection you can erect around these institutions. And ultimately, you know, I think all of us know that we are on, you know, on the front lines, you know, quite literally, many times in our careers. And to arrive in a situation, Tom, you know, where you have to have blast barriers and certainly everything else, that your organization becomes suddenly cut off from the street, that it becomes cut off from the story, that would be a very sad day. And I think that we've heard from so many media owners, certainly not just in France but elsewhere, saying that there are limits to this, and this is a very good example. This was, of course, very well coordinated. Horrendous what happened, but I don't think there are that many things that can be done. Now, of course, as the story continues to unfold, you know, could of course the security services maybe have kept these people in detention a bit longer, and certainly from a background perspective, from an intelligence point of view, certainly more could be done. But I'm not convinced. I don't feel that this is, you know, a call for any organizations to necessarily erect bigger walls.
Absolutely. The reflections there of our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, from Switzerland. Tyler, thanks for joining us as always. And we'll continue the discussion with our guests from France and here in the studio in Midori House right after this. I'm joined here in the studio by Nick Newman, the head cartoonist for the UK's foremost satirical publication, Private Eye, a brazen, cynical, wry, esoteric, crazy, established anti-establishment. This light but hard-hitting fortnightly is a magazine that, through satire, has become a voice of reason when it comes to political journalism. Also with us here in the studio is Michael Deacon, who, as political sketch writer for The Telegraph, is familiar with the potency of satire, of bit of provocative journalism, and making therefore pretty full use of all of his press freedoms. Also on the line from Paris, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Olivier Royan, editor-in-chief of France's most iconic weekly, Paris Match. And Olivier, perhaps I'll start with you first of all. Let me ask you this. A lot of French media, we've seen your own title, I know, also echoing this, endorsing the Je suis Charlie, holding those sorts of banners. But let me ask you about the aftermath of that. Once the dust has settled a little bit, do you think we'll see more caution or maybe more risk taking from the sort of from French publications as a result of what we've seen?
First of all, so far, I mean, the dust is not settling. I mean, it is very difficult to believe that all these men who have marked three or four generations of journalists are dead. You have to understand that, for example, Cabu and Georges Wolinski have been working for Paris Match since 1957 and 1990. And these men were, for us, an iconic figure of journalism. I mean, they were like models. We have a feeling sometimes that the press is getting more cautious on many issues, and the cartoonists, they never give up their free spirit, and that's why we are losing such a the emotion is so strong among us, among journalists particularly, because they were models for us and we are missing something. You have to understand that these guys were so kind. I mean, they have killed the kindest man we know. I mean, they were just extraordinary kind people doing their job, working, defending the freedom of the press. So it's very difficult to expect what's going to happen now from in the weeks to come and in the months to come. We saw that all the media companies, all the magazines were teaming up to make sure that Charlie Hebdo would be on the newsstand next Wednesday. And from what I have known tonight, I know that Charlie Hebdo will be published next Wednesday. So symbolically, it will mean that the killers didn't win. They didn't kill Charlie Hebdo, actually. Charlie Hebdo will be on the newsstand. And they expect to publish 1 million copies of the magazine next Wednesday. Now it's very difficult to expect. You know Sharp, for example, Stéphane Charbonnier, Sharp, the editor-in-chief of Charlie Hebdo, was feeling threatened all the time. He was under protection. I mean, the policeman that was protecting him was killed because he didn't have time to take his gun out. He was living under fear. I mean, the team of Charlie Hebdo, the newsroom of Charlie Hebdo was living under the threat. These men were extraordinary, and they were capable to live with this threat, and they were capable to tolerate this threat. I have a feeling that France is coming from today on in a new era in the fight against terrorism. And this national union that you're seeing appearing since yesterday will mean that the press will be very eager to prove that this killer yesterday didn't succeed in silencing us.
Well, Olivier, I'm going to ask you a bit more about that sort of new unified front in a moment or two, but I want to bring in my guests here in the studio as well, Nick Newman from Private Eye, first of all. There's a lot of talk about the importance, and Olivier was talking there about the importance of the work that these men had been doing, the role they played in not just the media landscape, but the wider Parisian, you know, political landscape. Satire clearly really important. Is there a fine line, though, to walk between where the satire ends and what something that somebody deems offensive begins? Do you think that always has to be a satirical point, or sometimes is offensiveness almost the point of the exercise?
Well, I think it is there's a sort of grey area. I think over here we're always trying to strive for the satirical point rather than being offensive for its own sake. I'm not suggesting that the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists were trying to be offensive for its own sake. They were incredibly courageous and men of great conviction. And I wish I had their conviction and courage. But on this side of the channel, I think we're a lot more circumspect. It's been noticeable that the newspapers around Europe have been carrying the Charlie Hebdo cartoons on their front pages. They haven't been in the national press here. Why is that? I think we're just a lot more cautious about provoking a kind of reaction that they have sadly, tragically provoked and been victims of. I think there may be a sort of historical context here that back in the 1920s, one of our top cartoonists, David Lowe, who later became Sir David Lowe, drew a really inoffensive cartoon about the cricketer Jack Hobbs, saluting him as a sort of colossus of the game. And he did this cartoon which featured Jack Hobbs as this giant figure alongside a lot of statues of people like Caesar and Napoleon and diminutive figures, and one of whom was the prophet. As a result of that, there were threats of riots in India. It caused an enormous furore. Ever since then, I think our national newspapers have been very, very careful about unintentionally provoking a reaction.
Well, let me ask you, Michael, then, about that risk, I guess, when you're writing, you know, sharp satire or, you know, very sort of politically, you know, a little risky. If you're writing that kind of piece, do you pause to consider then the reactions of the targets of the satire, or are you only preoccupied with the reactions of the readers of your material?
No, you write only for your readers. You can't go thinking about what the targets think, particularly if they're politicians. But it's easy for me. You know, I live in a country where the worst thing, or at least I think the worst thing that can happen to me, is people write abusive comments under my articles on the internet, or they send me abusive tweets or something like that. I'm not scared of them. And I think actually that's why people are so shaken by this particular terrorist attack. I mean, any terrorist attack is terrifying enough. Let's say terrorists blow up a bus. Well, that's horrifying, and they don't give a reason. Still horrifying. But in this particular case, they've murdered people, apparently, for the crime of exercising freedom of speech. And I think that scares us even more in the West, because we are so used to having freedom of speech, and we rely on it utterly, and we're terrified of having it taken away.
Olivier, if I can just cross back to you then and ask you about the point really that Michael makes there, this collective sense of shock, a collective sense of outrage, it's resulting in the kind of unity that you were actually describing, you know, before. Are you very confident that we will see a unified approach, a unanimity of attitude? Or do you think, you know, is there a risk that there are, you know, lunatic fringes or people who will seek to cause further division and cause further upset as a result of this? Or are you confident this unified approach will have an enduring legacy?
You know, we live in a strange time, the reality of a week is different from the reality from 3 or 4 weeks from now. I have a feeling that the moment of the march of Sunday that will gather the left, the government party, and the opposition party, would mean the government of François Hollande and Nicolas Sarkozy, will be very important, because I think the French people expect a true picture of unifying politicians on this front. It is very difficult to know if this united front will remain as it is, but it's going to be important. We will know Sunday night or Sunday afternoon if the politicians are really serious about being united on these things. Yesterday night at the silent demonstration at the République Plaza, some people tried to burn a Quran, and people expelled this person from the demonstration. There is a feeling, I think, of responsibility these days, and of course there are crazy stuff going on the social networks and crazy words circulating. But what's happening on the streets of Paris and the streets of the different big cities in France is a true moment of unity, which is something we haven't seen for a long time, because we have a feeling that the French people are so divided these days, and so divided precisely in front of this issue of how do we deal with terrorism, and is it this war for real within the country. You have to understand that this great man, I mean, this man that we admire so much, I mean, Cabu, Volinsky, Sharp, all these guys, they were killed by little guys. I mean, this totally lost guy from the suburb that were totally excluded from the system. This is truly absurd. I mean, this is a war. I mean, the French people, we understand that this is a war, and this war comes from within. I mean, you don't have to look for suspects in some strange countries. I mean, the killers were from France and from these suburbs of France, and that adds to the shock that we are feeling these days.
Olivier Royon, the editor-in-chief of Paris Match, thanks very much for joining us here on The Stack. We'll be getting more insights on this story and on the role of satire in the contemporary media from Nick and Michael as well a little later in the programme. Up next, though, we're going to be hearing from Jeffrey Kaufman about his trip to meet the Charlie Hebdo team back in 2012. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, before we continue our discussion on this special edition of the programme, we're going to hear from ABC's correspondent in London, Jeffrey Kaufman, who back in 2012 visited the offices of Charlie Hebdo the year after they were firebombed in another attack. We're here at Monocle's David Pleasant speaking with Jeffrey after hearing this extract from his ABC report.
Our job is not to defend freedom of speech, but without freedom of speech, we are dead. We can't live in a country without freedom of speech. I prefer to die than live like a rat, I don't know.
And to be afraid of being speaking?
I haven't the right, the time to be afraid. I have a paper to do.
Jeffrey Kaufman, on the line. That was an extract of a report that you did on Charlie Hebdo back in 2012. And that was the voice of Stéphane Charbonnier, or Sharb, as he was known, speaking there, the editor. First of all, Jeffrey, can you tell us what your impressions were of the man, of Sharb, of the office he ran? What were your lasting kind of memories of that visit?
I can tell you that when I hear that soundbite, and I've heard it, as you can imagine, over and over in the last 24 hours, it just takes my breath away. It's as if he knew this moment was going to come. This is a man who was as deeply principled as any journalist I've met. His way of expressing himself is through, or was through, humor, satire. He was not afraid to offend. And much of what Charlie Hebdo is about is exposing hypocrisy and hatred. And as they saw it, and as the survivors presumably still see it, it is about exposing religion, whether it's the Muslim faith, Christianity, Judaism, and the hypocrisy that they see comes in the name of religion. And as he said, why should the Muslim people get a free pass? We can criticize everybody else and they don't threaten to kill us. We live under French law, not under Sharia law. This is a free and democratic society, and that's what we are expressing here. I remember him saying to me, we've never killed anyone with a pen.
That's interesting to hear you say that, Jeffrey. What people are sort of intimating slightly, obviously tragic events, and nobody expected this. But even from that clip, we got the sense, as you said, that he predicted what might happen to him. Do you feel his everyday work was provoking, or was he just doing what he did best?
You know, you can. There's a parallel with the recent Hollywood film that showed the mock assassination of Kim Jong-un, the Korean president and dictator, which caused so much anger in North Korea. That was just a silly, goofy, offensive piece of Hollywood play. These guys are not about that. I mean, these guys are about making serious points. They do it in a way that is clearly offensive. But, you know, it's part of the French culture and tradition. It goes back to the French Revolution. Pointed, offensive satire is just part of the language of French journalism. This is not simply an organization that did stuff because they got a kick out of it. They really had and have serious principles behind this. And as I say, these guys wanted to expose what they see as the inconsistencies and the hatred that is spouted in the name of religion. So it would be a mistake to think that these were just a bunch of college kids out for a laugh.
And finally, Jeffrey, you visited the office. You've got more insights than just about anyone. What do you think the future of this kind of, what is quite a small setup, even in France, that has a big tradition, you know, a decimating attack on a small magazine? This is for the Stack that we're listening to now, our print show. What do you think the impact is on this kind of journalistic expression?
You know, it'll be interesting to see. I think on one level, you can imagine people saying, we're not going to be beaten. We're not going to be crushed by this kind of violence and menace. On another level, you've seen, 9, 10 members of the staff of Charlie Hebdo, a small operation. I mean, that's most of the staff killed in what execution style. It will take a whole new group of people with a lot of courage to pick up what they've left behind. So it's not clear that they can move forward. The paper circulation weekly was about 30,000. It is not a profit center. It struggled. It went out of business for a number of years and then came back. But it has had a loyal following and has had a lot of attention because of the kind of provocative work it does. Whether it can continue, it's really too. I think we're too close to it now. I think it's something you want to, it's a question worth raising in a couple of weeks when we have a little distance.
That was Jeffrey Kaufman talking about his recollections of his visit to Charlie Hebdo a couple of years back. Nick Newman and Michael Deacon are both still with me. Michael, perhaps I'll turn to you. How important do you think it is to sort of take on that point that Jeffrey was alluding to there, that the Charlie Hebdo, the next edition, does indeed, you know, come out, that it's met with a rapturous response, that it's engaged with not just in Paris or in France, but indeed around the world? It's that kind of continuity sends a hugely important message, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, they're talking about a print run of 1 million copies. Compare that with the usual 30,000. I think every single one of those 1 million will sell out. Now, I don't know how it'll sell in weeks after that, but I think next week's is so important because it's almost, there's something almost comforting about it. It's just a gesture that says, we will not be defeated, you will not defeat us.
And Nick, presumably you sort of echo that view, not just as a member of the sort of, you know, cartoonist union, as you will, but, you know, as part of a great satirical publication with a rich history of its own, I guess you more than anyone will feel the importance of continuing to spread that message.
I think it's absolutely brilliant to hear that they're coming out, and it just proves that the pen is mightier than the Kalashnikov. And there are many cartoonists here who want to help if they can, and I'm sure we all will. And I mean, it just goes to prove that you know how deluded you are if you can go in and say I've killed Charlie Hebdo. More people have seen those cartoons worldwide than they would have ever done. As you said, a circulation of 30,000. Millions and millions of people have now been exposed to those cartoons.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the disciplines, I guess, of satire, because that's one of the things that's, you know, people are understandably, you know, scrutinising presently. Michael, I'll ask you, I mean, do you find that, you know, if you're writing a satirical piece, do you feel a sense of self-censorship? You talked earlier in the programme about writing just for your audience and not concerning yourself with the targets of your satire. But you know, have you ever felt compelled to self-censor? Is there a sort of a klaxon that sounds in your head when you think, I'm not sure if this is too close to the bone or not?
Well, the only question I ask myself is, you know, is what I am writing actually true? I don't want to abuse someone just for the amusement or pleasure of hurting them. I want to say something about, you know, I write about politicians. So if I'm writing about a politician's speech that he or she has given, you know, and I think there's a particular untruth that they are expressing, I want to highlight that and ridicule it and expose it in some way. I'm not going to mock their haircut just for the sake of it, although I do describe a politician's appearance, but usually when I do that, I'm trying to bring out something about their character and their temperament, and you often can do that. I don't just say someone's fat, ha-ha, look at fatty there. You describe someone in such a way as to say something about their personality. So, no, I don't self-censor. I simply ask myself, am I right here?
Nick, I see sort of, you know, smiling and sort of nodding sagely there to that. Is that the kind of dynamic, this kind of discussion that would take place in the private eye offices? Is that the sort of consideration that there is? It's not some sort of, you know, grand, hugely, you know, principled stance. It's simply about what you feel is right and wrong, and that's the end of it.
I mean, it's ultimately up to the editor on the day what he wants to put in. I think most cartoonists don't really self-censor. You know, we have a very we have very bad thoughts going on in our heads, and you tend to put them down on paper in a way to sort of get them out of the system, and it's sort of up to other people to edit them. You know, one person's extremely poor taste joke is somebody else's funniest joke of the millennium. You know, so it's a very hard thing to gauge as a cartoonist. You know, we tend to work at a distance from publications. You're not a sort of really in the body of the editorial decision making. I'm in a slightly different position because I do write the jokes for Private Eye as well. So I've got more of a sense of what the editorial ethos is. But for most cartoonists, you know, they're all over the country and they're working in isolation, and they are just sort of churning out stuff which they hope hits the target. It's taste is such a very, very difficult thing to get right. So much of humour is to do with timing. You know, comedy is all about timing. And I can remember many years ago when there was a Townsend Torrington ferry turned over, and I did suggested a cartoon for the paper that I was working for at the time, the London Daily News, a thing about ferries which were called ro-ro ferries, roll-on, roll-over ferries. And everybody sat around on the day saying, that's just shocking. You know, you should feel thoroughly ashamed of yourself. 2 days later, it was the main headline on the in the Times. You know, it's 2 days later, I would have been okay, but...
Well, of course, in Private Eye, every issue, you publish letters from readers who say, I have been a subscriber for 36 years and I have always loved your irreverent style, but this time, in the latest issue, you have gone too far and I am cancelling immediately. And I always find, I don't know about you, but I always find those letters hilarious because it makes me think, what have they been reading for 36 years? Just the adverts or something? Have they actually missed the content of this? Because if you didn't like this latest joke, how could you have tolerated the previous 36 years' worth?
It's utterly baffling. We love our readers, obviously, but a lot of them are barking mad.
Well, let me ask about, I guess it's a facet of that, which is that there does seem to be an impact, and I guess what you're saying there, Michael, speaks to this, that when something's committed to the page, the printed page in particular, it seems to have a power, and we saw this with Charlie Hebdo as well, beyond just the sheer image or the writing. When it's in print, it seems to have a power beyond anything else. Are you sort of aware of that, you know, Michael, writing for, you know, an august newspaper? There's this sort of Fleet Street tradition. People, one would imagine, will take greater offence rather than if you had, say, blogged something or put something on social media because it appears on the pages of a newspaper. It's still different, isn't it?
I think there is that is true, although it's actually irrational because newsprint is ephemeral. People read it one day and then they throw it in the recycling and it's never seen again, whereas actually online is, or should be, more harmful because once you've published something online, it will be there until the end of time or until the internet is abolished. So actually, you would think that a piece of satire that's just written on a blog is, or should be, more harmful than a piece of paper that can be burnt or just thrown out. But no, you're right. I think people do, for some reason, still take newsprint more seriously and find it more wounding, just because I suppose it looks more official somehow.
Perhaps it's
particularly under a masthead like the Daily Telegraph's, you know, sort of newspaper of record.
It doesn't get any more official.
It is now a fact, Mr. Cameron, that you have a bald spot that moves from side to side week by week. That kind of thing, you know. They take it more seriously.
I do. I find it, in this instance, it's extraordinary, the power of a cartoon image, that it can create this kind of furore. I mean, it's just somebody scribbling on a piece of paper and, you know, it's causing a clash of cultures. Who would have thought it, really?
Well, Nick, can I just ask you one final point about that? You say it's just a scrawling piece of paper. I mean, you're a connoisseur of cartoon history. We've spoken before about your, you know, compendiums of extraordinary volumes of half a century of Private Eye mirth. But tell me, you know, does this sort of thing ever worry you that, you know, the next generation of people might be cowed in some way? You know, the budding cartoonists of the future might say, I'm not sure if this is a game I want to be playing. Or is it maybe even the contrary? They say, wow, look at that power. I'm intrigued to explore.
Well, I think the latter. I think it's immensely empowering for would-be cartoonists to think that people actually take notice of your stuff. For a long time, you know, you sort of, as a cartoonist, you churn stuff out and it's into a sort of vacuum and you don't get much of a reaction. It either gets published or, or binned. And for the most part, you're sort of, it's silent comedy. You're working to a sort of completely silent audience. You know, I love it when I get complaints. I mean, I really don't want to offend people. I don't want people to be upset by my stuff. But it proves that you're provoking a reaction and that people are actually reading it.
That's a good note on which to draw to a close. My thanks to Nick Newman from Private Eye, Michael Deacon also from the Daily Telegraph. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Coming to speak to us here on The Stack. Thank you. And that does indeed bring us to the end of this edition 124 of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards, here in London. A special thanks to all of my guests today, Tyler in Switzerland, Nick Newman, Michael Deacon here in London, and Olivier Royon in Paris. Thanks too to our producer, David Pleasant, and our studio manager, Claire Arban. Send your comments to us here at info@monocle.com and tune in again for more of The Stack at the same time next week. For this week's episode, though, that's all. Goodbye.